Lake Eugenie Land and Exploration versus BP Exploration and Production Incorporated, et al. Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Theodore
Mr. Olson, would you, we don't want to take up all the time on jurisdiction, but would you address what we have jurisdiction of and how that is determined?
We believe that you have jurisdiction of the March 5 District Court decision as well as the April 5 decision dismissing the complaint against the claims administrator and denying an injunction. And jurisdiction is found under Section 1292A3 with respecting the rights and obligations of parties in admiralty. You have jurisdiction under the collateral order doctrine. You have jurisdiction because of the dismissal of the suit against the claims administrator, which is not disputed at this point. You have jurisdiction because there's a denial under 1292A1 of the injunction, of the preliminary injunction. And you have jurisdiction under the Walker decision of this court of a judgment, a decision interpreting a settlement agreement.
On the collateral order doctrine, how is that distinct from the merits?
Because this is a construction of a settlement agreement. It is different from the merits of the claims that are brought for damages with respect to the oil spill. This is an interpretation, a final interpretation, which is binding, otherwise unreviewable, of the settlement agreement and the terms of the settlement agreement. So collectively, all of those provisions to which I just referred provide jurisdiction of this court. Each independently, we submit, provides jurisdiction for the court. But you do have an unusual situation here, and we have cited the cases from this court that suggest with respect to the interpretation of a consent order that is binding upon the parties and resolves the rights of claimants and of BP, that gives you jurisdiction. Collateral order doctrine, otherwise this is unreviewable. Irreparable injuries are taking place, and money is being dispensed to parties from whom it might not ever be recoverable. So this
if you keep on appealing internally, isn't it likely the district court is going to have to revisit all of this?
I don't think so. The district court has indicated that is not willing to do so, has basically ordered us not to continue to appeal, and is to appeal decisions with respect to his interpretation of the settlement order, and has basically said you can't appeal individual awards to this court. So my client is in a very difficult situation. This is a otherwise dispositive order with respect to rights under the settlement agreement, which is costing literally billions of dollars, and the correctness or incorrectness of that decree is not otherwise reviewable, and the district court has decided that and made it very clear that he does not want to hear any more arguments with respect to these issues. We had no choice, and we sought relief with this court in every means available to us to stop the hemorrhaging of cash, which is otherwise not going to be recoverable, potentially at least.
Well, where do you have the authority to appeal to this court, to the circuit court? I can see where your claims administration panel takes a shot at it. If you don't like that, you can go to the court, that's the district court, Judge Barbier. But how do you leapfrog to us for this?
Well, the provisions that I cited in the judicial code, the fact that there was a under the Walker decision of this court and other decisions of this court, there was a resolution, a final interpretation for all intents and purposes of the settlement agreement. The collateral order doctrine gives the right to appeal to this court under the circumstances that are prevalent here. It's a subsidiary issue, not central to the main issue. It's otherwise unreviewable. It's dispositive of the rights of the parties. The damage is occurring as we speak in a consistent and large and immense way. And so there's really no other alternative. Plus,
Mr. Olson, you're certainly right on alternatives, and it is a major problem, so I accept the difficulty for you. But let's break this down as you have in your brief. As I understand what you call the settlement action, that was filed by you after Judge Barbier, by BP, after Judge Barbier on March 5 upheld the interpretation of the agreement. Judge Barbier said there was no claim there, that you're basically accusing breach of contract and otherwise the claims administrator for following what Judge Barbier said. If we agree with that, which we would be errant to do, I'm sure you would say, isn't that case over on appeal? We would affirm the dismissal for the reasons or slightly different ones. Nothing else comes up with that. So don't you need, and you've argued others, if we do agree with Judge Barbier, isn't the settlement appeal over?
I don't think so, because the settlement appeal is you would have to address the merits in order to do that. And because this is a
– Reading the merit, whether this – excuse me for interrupting, Mr. Olson, that the administrator was in error for following what the district court said, as opposed to the district court was in error.
Well, I think it's inextricably intertwined with the merits of the decision by the district court interpreting the settlement agreement. And when you put that together with the other provisions that we cited, the admiralty jurisdiction, collateral order jurisdiction, and the other issues that are involved in this case, this is otherwise an impossible situation, and injury is going to be done, and it is irreparable. This is exactly what this court is for. It is a circumstance that is quite unusual, unquestionably, but is what this court's jurisdiction is for.
I have a question, sir. In your reply brief, you said the only issue in this appeal is the lost profit calculation. And then you were talking about how the variable profit is to be calculated, those issues relevant to applying 4C's causation framework. My problem is, I think the real issue in the case is causation and consideration. If you look at 4B, where is BP's consideration for agreeing to pay those claims without proving they were caused by the oil spill?
Well, this is a settlement, and with respect to the causation issue, that is not the issue that is before this court, of course. We haven't briefed that. That is a
It will be here sooner.
It may be.
It may control this entire disposition.
It may be, but that settlement agreement with respect to 4B as to causation provided a mechanism which allowed someone to come through the door to be then entitled to prove the amount of actual lost profits. It was a compromise, which every settlement agreement is, with respect to causation issues. Some businesses that are very close to the oil spill, the causation issue is waived entirely.
Right.
With respect,
I'm not talking about those. I'm talking about the example that Administrator Juno sent out for comments, where if there's an accounting firm of three members, one is hospitalized for several months, of course they lose money. It's totally unrelated to the oil spill, but yet the BP lawyers, two of them in fact, said that would be recoverable, that would be presumed. How can that logically be correct? Where is the legal connexity between a damage or an injury and the ability to make BP pay for it?
It was a part of a compromise which there's going to be thousands and tens of thousands
of. So where's the consideration?
The consideration is a consideration of a settlement class as a whole. But the causation issue is going to be different with respect to each particular claimant. Judgments were made with respect to compromises on proof of causation in order, but only in order to get to the point of proving the actual lost profits. And that's what is the fundamental issue that was decided below and was what is before
this. Well, major consideration is no one can bring suit against you on the oil spill outside of this class action, which you have now you have settled.
Exactly, Your Honor.
And they couldn't bring suit against you anyway if it wasn't caused by
they would could bring suit. They'd have to prove causation. They could, and this is a compromise of tens of thousands of claims. But the important thing and the issue that we're talking about here is assuming causation, assuming that a claimant gets through the door and is now entitled to prove lost profits. We then come to what everyone agrees in this case. The appellees say this on page 27 of their brief. This appeal presents a straightforward question of contract interpretation. The judge, when he reviewed the reasonableness of the settlement, specifically said, to paraphrase him, that this was an intend, the process was intended to calculate actual lost profits according to generally accepted and widely understood accounting terms and common and regularly applied methodologies. Now, our point with respect to this is that the formula provides for a calculation of revenue and expenses. Those terms are commonly understood and widely accepted in the accounting and economics profession with respect to calculation of lost profits.
Aren't you just taking individual words out of the settlement and constructing a purpose and a scheme that you would like based on that? This case has not been tried. This is an agreement between the parties, and the parties have opposing interests, and the parties have given up things in order to gain things.
Yes,
now,
but
it seems to me that something that you gave up was the agreement defines what is a lost profit in a particular way.
Yes, it does.
And you had a chance to not agree to that, several chances.
Well,
so how can we go beyond the four corners of the agreement?
Precisely, Your Honor, we don't expect you to go beyond the four corners of the agreement. But the agreement has terms, as the district court acknowledged, and no one has really disputed, that are terms of generally accepted meaning in the accounting profession with respect to the calculation of lost profits. So, yes, there's one thing is to agree to an agreement. These are precise terms. There are at least 20 experts already on record in this case stating that revenues and expenses have terms that are understood. They refer to the addition of assets with respect to what a business earns, an adjustment of that figure by the expenses that are attributable to creating those revenues during a corresponding period. Those terms have understood meaning, and what we're saying is that that is what was agreed to, and no expert, not even our opponents, say that those terms, revenue and expenses, mean cash receipts or expenditures. Cash receipts or expenditures is a happenstance of when certain money comes in for work that may have been performed earlier or later, but it does not allow you to calculate lost profits. The purpose of this agreement was to determine how much profits were earned or weren't during the claim period.
The purpose of this agreement is to settle the dispute between the parties.
Certainly, Your Honor.
And you reached an agreement. And I don't think we can stand back and say, well, the purpose was to comply with all knowledgeable accounting experts' idea of what lost profits is.
The purpose was, there is no question about what the purpose was, to calculate the amount of profits lost during a claim period versus a benchmark period, and the calculation of the difference between a comparable period here and a comparable period here. There's no question about the purpose. Now, when individuals or entities such as this use commonly accepted, this court has done this over and over and over again, when terms of art are used in an agreement and there's no dispute about what those terms mean, they should be applied as they're understood in the profession.
Mr. Olson, let me ask you about that. It seems to me that there are a lot of compromises in this settlement, and causation that Judge Clement was talking about earlier is a huge compromise. And our issue in part is how much more is what you're talking about a compromise. One of the things that concerns me is this October 2, 2012 conference call, and that's one of the matters that your opposing counsel focus on, that you had, your client had previous opportunities to notice that this was the way the matter would be calculated, how you would match or not match expenses and revenue. Is there any evidence, or what would you say the evidence is, and maybe I'll hear from the other side too, that shows your client knew well in advance of what we're talking about today, the January 15 administrative ruling, that this was the way, that you weren't going to match in the way that you're now arguing it should be matched?
I submit that there is no evidence that my clients knew what was going on with respect to this. In fact, this was an interpretation of the settlement agreement that was not shared with my clients at the time it was made for some reason. But then we found out about
it. What are you talking about? You said this wasn't shared.
This definition, the variable profits definition, which is the issue involved in this case, the coming to that decision using cash receipts and expenditures as opposed to expenses and revenue, that decision was not known to my client. There is no waiver here. My client did everything possible as soon as it realized what was going on by finding out by these aberrational and basically admittedly disproportionate awards.
You paid out of what, $1 billion before you objected to this?
Well, the problem, Your Honor, is that there was no way to know that the formulation was being used, which is different than the formulation that was being agreed to. That was not known. There's no evidence that that was known by my clients. It may have been.
Why were the 62 Bell simulations that your client prepared and that the administrator prepared the claims counsel? Why were they so similar? How did you get the same results if you weren't using
those? Because the examination of that computer model didn't reveal the manner in which the numbers were being determined. It did not reveal that those were receipts.
But your people computed those.
Using the same numbers. It was a comparison of two computer models to see whether they would come out
the same. You're saying you didn't know that those numbers came within the same 3 month.
No, what we didn't know is that the numbers were calculated used based upon cash receipts in and out the door, which my clients would never have agreed upon because that's the one system that cannot show lost profits. Your Honor, I don't want to abuse my – thank you.
You have 5 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you so much.
Mr. Ishikaroff.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Samuel Zakharoff for the class counsel. If I may, I'll briefly address the jurisdictional question. It is difficult to see how this Court has jurisdiction. Frankly, we would prefer a ruling by this Court that would get this issue off the table once and for all so that we can go on with the administration of the settlement.
Well, if you would win, you would prefer that.
Your Honor, this is actually a piece of a very large settlement, and there's a lot of administration to be done, and this has been holding up and taking a lot of people's time. We would actually prefer a resolution. The problem we have is that the settlement provides two mechanisms to get issues up to the district court. Under Section 4.34 of the settlement, there is the ability to ask for a policy determination, and that's what was done in this case, and that seems to end with the district court with its discretionary review. There is another provision of the settlement under Section 6, which allows for challenges to individual determinations. To the extent that this is a facial challenge to the interpretation coming out of the January 15th resolution by Mr. Juno, that is arguably closer to the jurisdictional ambit of this court. However, the briefs are filled with as-applied instances and undigested expert reports and untested matters. In fact, they concede in their reply brief that some of the claims that they're complaining about haven't even gone through the internal appeals process yet. So on that issue, there can clearly be no jurisdiction because there's no order of a lower court that is capable of being reviewed by this court.
Well, counsel, on the collateral order doctrine, it seems to me from BP's viewpoint, what you have is a policy decision announced on January 15 reflecting what your clients on this side say had been known for a good while, and Mr. Olson says otherwise. And that is going to lead to decisions that are being made that in the administrative process will continue to apply this standard or this lack of a need to match in the way that opposing counsel says. It seems to me on a collateral order doctrine that's the sort of fundamental, sort of unreviewable later decision that perhaps would fit.
Well, the difficulty with the collateral order doctrine's application here is that the payment to the parties who are the beneficiaries of the settlement is not collateral to the settlement. It is the heart of the settlement. And if they are complaining about actual payments to individuals, as they do throughout their brief, that is in the nature of an appeal from a final order. And they have not perfected that record at this point. I don't know of any case of this court where collateral order doctrine is used to address the resolution of the claims between A and B, where A and B are the principals in the case. It's used for attorney's fees and matters of that sort. So, for example, they rely on the Walker case, which is not a collateral order doctrine. That's their best case, and Mr. Olson invoked it here. In Walker, what you have is the modification of an injunction to order a party afresh to pay $1.8 million. And if one looks at page 125, and particularly at note 8 of the Walker decision, what you see is that this is a mootness challenge, that this case is over, and this court rightly says it's not over. You just ordered somebody to pay $1.8 million. That's between A and B. Those are the principles in the case. I'm not aware of any case, and they have not cited any case, where a dispute between the primary parties is handled under the collateral order doctrine, Your Honor.
Did you anticipate this feeding frenzy where people would come out of the woodwork not being able to prove all spill-related claims and that they would be approved? I have a hard time understanding why that would be contemplated in part of the settlement, that an actual person with no legal claim would get in line for a legal recovery.
Your Honor, if one looks at the settlement agreement, one sees that there are four zones that are covered, and almost all of these disputes come out of Zone D. What's interesting is that zones A, B, and C are drawn with surgical precision. They follow streets, they take in a shopping mall, they cut out a shopping mall or a business. Everybody costed those out. What the record indicates, and I can't obviously speak of the settlement negotiations, but what the record indicates is that Zone D is a massive catchment area. And it's a massive catchment area because, apparently, BP wanted peace. And that's what they went to the district court and said at the fairness hearing. I would direct the court's attention to a very fine document produced by Dr. Velrath on behalf of Halliburton. Halliburton was afraid it was going to get saddled with the terms of the settlement.
And they backed out.
They have not. There's no settlement with Halliburton. And the Dr. Velrath, in his opinion, takes a small rural county in northeast Mississippi, Benton County, which has about 10,000 people, has no tourism industry, no seafood industry that I'm aware of, and says, if you map this settlement onto Benton County, every retail industry in Benton County would qualify, even though it's far from the Gulf, even though it has nothing to do with the Tennessee border. And BP said, that's the settlement we want.
Why doesn't that destroy commonality of the class if you're paying people who have no real loss, no real injury related to the spill?
Well, Your Honor, we don't know who has injury and who has loss. It's in the nature of a class settlement that there are always people.
How about the accounting firm?
This is what they agreed to. Now,
it doesn't make it legally correct. It doesn't make it.
Well, Your Honor,
viable under the class action rules.
Well, it does, because they are buying peace from potential claims, and these are people who are within the zone of a compromised business environment. That's what this settlement's about. BP understood, to its credit, that it had destroyed the business environment of the Gulf. It wasn't just the toxic spill in the Gulf. It was the business environment throughout this region. And so they decided they wanted all these claims off the table. They didn't want to face punitive damage awards. They didn't want to face any of the liabilities that would ensue from this. This could have been settled in many ways. It could have been an opt-in class. It could have been a non-class. There were lots and lots. There's 175,000 people have filed, or businesses have filed claims already. This could have been handled on a one-by-one basis. The decision was to have a class because they wanted global peace. And when they got global peace, it necessarily had all potential claimants. So we have no way of testing these unless we unwind the settlement and start trying them on a one-by-one basis.
Well, counsel, let me ask about that world peace, global peace, whatever it is that you said. It seems to me applied to causation. And even Exhibit 4C, this addendum that is quoted so much, seems to be saying that what we have determined will be the way to compute or determine whether causation exists or not. That's what some of the addendum seems to be doing, comparing causation months to the months for compensation. It seems to me that most of what you have pointed out, both sets of counsel on your side, is talking about causation and the global peace that was reached for that. On the issue of damages, it does seem to me that I don't see in the emails and the other evidence, and I certainly don't know the record the way you and the other counsel do, I don't see that supported. So let me ask you what I asked Mr. Olson. When do you say BP would have known, and why would they have known it, that you were going to not match, or whatever you want to call what the January 15 administrator's decision policy statement was? When would they have known that that's the way it was being done?
Your Honor, on April 4th, BP received a memo from Price Waterhouse, the accounting firm of its choice, identifying these matching problems. They said that if there are not changes implemented, you would pick up firms and they would have these kinds of damages if you did not smooth the revenues. And that's the term that keeps floating around here.
Aren't they suggesting making the time periods longer, perhaps? Is that in that same memo?
If you make the time frames longer, and there was a dispute at the time, Your Honor's right, between 3 and 9 months, and ultimately they compromised at 6 months. But if you make the time longer, you smooth necessarily. And the decision in the negotiations was not to do that. BP did not implement this after April 4th. On May 8th, the parties made a joint presentation and tutorial to the claims administrator that Mr. Stanley will address more directly. And again, there, the same methodology was put forward and the same issue was not changed. It was the same methodology that was continued. On June 19th, we had what Judge Clement referred to earlier as the beta test or the trial test of the BEL frameworks, and the parties came up with the identical results, virtually identical results.
How do you respond to how Mr. Olson responded to Judge Clement? He's saying that we didn't get down or wasn't shown the data and how you were matching or not matching. Is that factually incorrect?
It's not only incorrect, it's impossible. Because they ran computer simulations off the same 62 test. They had to have the same data, otherwise they couldn't get a bottom line number. So
they didn't know it was cash, that it was the cash receipts. That's what Mr. Olson.
Well, if they did know it was cash receipts, then the September 28th email letter from Mr. Holstein dispels that, if that's the claim. Because what Mr. Holstein says in the second of two, they're in our record exhibit, in the second of the two letters that are in our appendix, what he says is that we insist upon the actual profit and loss statements from the time period because we are afraid of any adjustment, alteration, in fact, he uses the word fraud as a potential that could come if people could adjust their the way they keep their business records. Everyone in the Gulf knows that small businesses operate on a cash basis. Only now do we have an exhibit put in by Mr. Hall that's in their record exhibit saying, no, you must change everybody to generally accepted accounting principles. Only now do we have BP saying, no, revenues do not mean when the cash comes in, no matter how you keep your records. Revenue means it has to be when the activity that gave rise to it, and you have some absurd examples here, such as law firms that do a contingent practice, who knows when that activity...
Well, I was under the impression that this whole apparatus was transparent, that BP could see what was happening and didn't object until December.
Your Honor, we knew all along, and I was just going through the list, and again, in July, there were the first BEL claims were being paid, and again, there was no objection from BP. And then we have this exchange that Judge Clement talks about where Michael Juneau says, what about an accounting firm where one of the partners is out sick? I think that they had an understanding of this that was pretty clear. If I may, I'd like to turn to the actual language. Sure, of course.
You were talking about September 28th letter. Is this what Mr. Moskowitz referred to as relatively rare false positives?
He said concomitant false positives, which hopefully will be relatively rare. That is correct. But when you have 175,000 claims,
now they don't look so rare, do they?
Well, you don't know. Out of how many? It turns out that the numbers we're dealing with here, there have been 51,000 BEL claims that have been processed already. Of these, there are 1,741 that have been challenged on appeal. And Mr. Godfrey told the court at the and of those, about 1,500 are by BP. And Mr. Godfrey told the court on April 5th that BP was winning 79% of those. So the we don't know how rare or not rare it is. The record doesn't reflect that. There's a lot of rhetoric, but there's no evidence in the record. And we know that many of these haven't gone through the appellate process yet, so we don't even know what the awards are. So when BP goes around publicly and elsewhere saying billions and billions of dollars at stake, we don't know that.
Well, what about the fairness hearing on November 8th, where Mr. Godfrey said the settlement is working as we anticipated, and as we negotiated with Mr. Rice and Mr. Fayard? Is that referring to these kind of computations? I mean,
yes, and in fact, on that same page of the record, which I believe is page 27 of the fairness hearing record, further down the page, well, after he says, I'm sorry, not it's not the same page. Later on a couple of pages later, class counsel stood up and said, wait a second, the settlement is uncapped. They say 7.8, it could be 20, 25, 30 billion dollars. This is said in open court. There's no refutation by Mr. Godfrey at that time. So that it was unknown. It was unknown. They costed it out in a way that we thought was incorrect from the beginning. From the very beginning, we told them that, and we said that they shouldn't be advertising this number. This is what they turn to. If I could just have a minute to turn to the actual language, because I think that this is an important point that gets to Exhibit 4D, which I gave to the court. If one looks at page 2 of Exhibit 4C, where variable profit is defined, it says the following two steps. One, sum the monthly revenue over the period. And we know from 4A and 4B that means the monthly revenue maintained in the ordinary course of business. And then it says subtract the corresponding variable expenses from the revenue. There is no modifier on revenue. Revenue is revenue as it is maintained. Almost every example that they point to in this court and in the court below has to do with their demand that revenues be smoothed. And that's what they come back to again at the end of their reply brief. If you look at the definition,
you have exceeded your time.
I'm sorry. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Stanley.
Thank you, Your Honor. Rick Stanley. I'm here today for Pat Juneau and the settlement program. At the fairness hearing on November 8th, BP told the district court that the settlement program was, quote, working as anticipated, close quote, and that Mr. Juneau should be allowed to, quote, continue his excellent work, close quote. In their brief, BP claims now that by December 5th, it was challenging Mr. Juneau's administration because the program was reaching absurd results. So the question is asked, what changed in those 27 days? What happened? And I think this goes to the very question that this panel has been asking.
But let me ask the context for that. What the parties seem to be talking about are agriculture, construction, and maybe I think what the other one is professional services. Whatever this seems to be in BP's arguments, the central kinds of claims, what percentage, any idea what out of all these claims we're paying, how many are construction, agriculture, and whatever the other category was?
I don't
remember the third category or something.
I don't have the statistics, Judge. I wish that I did.
Are we talking about 10%, or are we talking about 75%? Any idea at all?
I do not. No, I don't think it's 75%. But I do think some of the larger claims have fallen in the industries of construction, agriculture, and professional services.
Well, I raise it here just because what you're saying, it could well be that the principal part of what BP was talking about at that hearing was the principal way in which it was just playing out, but not necessarily focusing on this.
Exactly. Let me direct your attention to the fact that I think answers your question. When I say that nothing had changed in those 27 days, I also mean nothing had changed since the inception of the program. In fact, on September 28th, Mr. Cantor, an attorney for BP, sent four questions to the administrator. And in the very first question, it raises the instance of the construction business and says, what are you doing about construction businesses that receive these lump sum payments? How are you treating that? It goes on to say, how are you dealing with the accounting methodology of all these businesses and how they report their income? The third question says, what are you doing about these year-end large expense or negative revenue entries that occur at the year-end? How are you treating those things? And the fourth question says, what are you doing about large spikes in expense? Or that's September 28th. That's 6 weeks before the fairness hearing. And if those questions sound very familiar to you, I think they should, because they're exactly the same questions that you're being asked to review right now. 6 weeks before the fairness hearing, those questions were asked. Your Honor mentioned a conference call on October 2nd. Those questions were answered by the program accountants.
There's no transcript of that conference call, is there, for us to know what was said?
There is no transcript. The evidence of the content of the call is in the affidavit of Mr. Hacker from Price Waterhouse, which is in the record and part of our record excerpts.
There was what you call, I guess, a warning of these revenue spikes and a discussion of how to smooth them out. Nothing was ever undertaken to make that change, was it?
Essentially, the
except lengthening, I guess, having the 3-month period.
No, Your Honor, nothing was changed. There was that discussion in April 4 about if you use such a short time period, especially with a cash basis taxpayer, you're inevitably going to get that. In fact, what the accountant suggested was just use the variable profit margin instead of expenses and revenues, and because they, I think, foresaw what was going to happen. And it also relates back to what Mr. Juneau in his, as I call it, the hypothetical of the three accountants raised at the same time period, that there are possibilities using the formula that is stipulated in the agreement that people with losses unrelated to the spill are going to get compensation. And I note for you, Mr. Juneau's email is not just about causation. He specifically talks about 4C, which is the compensation part. And Mr. Juneau was told, these are false positives that you're going to get. Well, now they're fraudulent and fictitious claims. In the few seconds I have left,
they might be.
And indeed they might be claims that are at least contended to be false and fictitious, but as counsel has noted, they're all potential claims. And until they would get proven out in court, no one would know. Under that hypothetical,
that they should be paid.
Our position, Judge, is that we will do whatever the courts tell us to do. We're just the claims administrator. We did not negotiate this deal. We have really no stake in the deal other than to execute it as efficiently as possible.
You've exceeded your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Olson, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. What this is coming down to from our opponents is that jurisdictionally you can't do anything about this situation. Your clients have been subject to a final interpretation that the district court has decided is unreviewable, that is costing immense amounts of money, irreparable injury, and you can't do anything about it. That is inconsistent with what this court has decided again and again with respect to the collateral order doctrine. There's also jurisdiction under the Walker case, and we responded to the argument that was made about the Walker case in our reply brief. The point is, this is an admiralty case, there's a disposition, there's something that needs to be reviewed here because justice will not be done otherwise. Money will be paid out, immense amount of money will be paid out, and there's a large potential that will never be recovered. So first, the argument is you can't do anything about what's going on here. The second argument that I heard over and over again from our opponents is you really knew about this problem and it's too late. It's too bad. Whatever the merits might be, it's too late for you to do it. Now, there's no real justification in the briefs of a waiver argument or an estoppel argument. We come to this court for an interpretation of a settlement agreement. Our opponents agree with us that the issue before this court is a straightforward interpretation of a contract. And you cannot tolerate the answer is that you should have known there were clues. All of those clues, if taken individually, don't signify that there was awareness that this systemic problem had infected the process so that receipts, cash receipts and cash out the door, which no one is really arguing, can prove actual lost profits and is producing the potential and actuality of fictitious awards, exaggerated awards, excessive awards, and our opponents are basically saying you should have figured that out and brought it a little sooner.
Why is there a judicial estoppel as a result of Mr. Godfrey's statement at the fairness hearing?
That was had to do, well, he was not aware at the time, and there's no evidence that he was aware of the systemic, massive dislocation of the settlement agreement, Part 4C, with respect to how this was being done. He was talking about a separate issue. If one looks at the transcript of that, it's clear that he did not know. It's clear also that BP did everything possible to do something about this once it found out that it was done. So there is no, I submit, estoppel or waiver. It really hasn't even been briefed in that respect.
But opposing counsel said BP knew before that, before November 8th.
They say that, yes, but they have not established that.
And all referring to some letters and some.
Pardon me?
He was making reference to letters.
Yes, he was making reference to letters which taken individually or are taken out of context, don't establish that point. They refer to this whole thing about Halliburton. They were focusing on what you were asking about earlier on, 4B. The fact is that there is no evidence and there's no reason why BP would have allowed this to go on. The hemorrhaging of potentially billions of dollars.
Mr. Olson, you have to admit, though, that there's something else at stake here, and that is whether or not a court-approved settlement of something this vast and this great can be accomplished, because if the parties can't come in and change the agreement after it's been made. BP misperceived how big these claims were going to be. But as I see it, they entered into a settlement agreement, and that there's been no litigation outside to establish any facts or anything. We look at this agreement, and I believe over and over, representatives of BP agreed to this way of measuring losses.
I respectfully disagree with respect to a couple of points, Your Honor. First place, no one's going to enter into this kind of settlement again if the meaning of commonly understood terms can be changed afterwards. It is not BP that has changed the interpretation of the agreement. The claims of the district court specifically said this settlement agreement is approved because it involves public, transparent frameworks that apply standardized formulas derived from generally accepted and common methodologies. All we're saying is that those common methodologies, those common terms have to be used with respect to this. If it's changed in this way, there's no commonality. There's no, if people are allowed to recover without proving actual losses, they are not claims representatives, and this will be upset. This is taking a settlement agreement that was intended to use commonly accepted terms. They're using terms that are not being defended anymore. They're basically making the argument, you thought about it, you didn't move fast enough, but we are here on time because we're asking a correct interpretation of an agreement that has words that are commonly understood in the accounting profession, and that's what the judge was looking at when he approved the settlement.
Thank you, Mr. Olson.
Judge Dennis, if I may have one question. Judge Barbier never found this agreement to be ambiguous, did he? Exhibit 4C language, and you have argued specifically it's not ambiguous. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
On both points?
Yes.
Correct. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.